Hi there, and welcome to Tech Setters. Carly Kloss here, and I am so excited to introduce you to this fantastic STEAM-focused podcast, helmed by two of my favorite techies, Samantha Weiner and Jenny Wang. I first met our hosts at Forbes 30 Under 30 conference a few years back, and their passion for creating a more diverse and equitable world in STEAM and their love of Code with Klossy was palpable. That passion and commitment, lots of compelling conversations, a few DMs, and a little magic later, Tech Setters the podcast was born. This season, we're sharing the stories of a few remarkable tech setters. These people have paved unconventional and impressive paths in their respective fields. By sharing their stories, we hope to open new opportunities for the Code with Klossy community and beyond. Each episode highlights the defining moments, challenges, and achievements that celebrate and define these trailblazers, showing listeners that there is a permanent seat at the table for everyone in the world of tech. So, without further ado, I present our first episode, a fascinating conversation with Joy Bulumwini, as she discusses her efforts to eliminate racial bias in AI and her incredible work as the founder of the Algorithmic Justice League. I hope you enjoy.
Hi, I'm Samantha Weiner.
I'm Jenny Wang, and you're listening to Tech Setters. Joy Bulumwini and I met years ago at a Woman in Tech conference, and upon meeting her, it was immediately clear to me that she was a force of nature. Today, Joy is a CS PhD student at MIT, Rhodes Scholar, and Fulbright Fellow, and the founder of the Algorithmic Justice League, which has the powerful mission of creating a world with more ethical technology. More recently, her documentary Coded Bias premiered at Sundance. On this episode, we'll learn exactly why Fortune magazine named her the conscience of the AI revolution. So Joy, it's been so long since we last caught up at the NC Wit Summit, and you've been up to so many things it's truly hard to keep track of. It's clear to me that you're so passionate about many things. We'd love to know, how did you first get started and why did you focus on your current topic of study?
No, it's so good to catch up since Vegas, which is interesting because we're having a computer science conference in Vegas where we're being awarded money. So I was like, wait, do they want us to keep the money? Temptation all around. So it's great to be connected. So how did I first get started with computer science? I really have to take it back to my parents. Growing up, I felt that I had all the options available for me in terms of what I wanted to explore. And my dad, being a professor of medicinal chemistry and pharmaceutical sciences, had a lab full of computers because he was doing computer-aided drug discovery. So from when I was a very little girl, I always had access to science and technology, and we had computers that he would bring home that I would say play with. They were educational tools, I believe. And so from a very early age, early exposure got me interested in technology, interested in computer science. And so when I got to undergrad, studying computer science was not too foreign. And how I got to studying my current topic, which is very much focused on issues of algorithmic bias and algorithmic discrimination, came from when I went to grad school at MIT, and I was working on an art installation. The art installation used facial analysis technology to detect and track a face. And in working on this project, the system I was using didn't detect my face consistently until I literally put on a white mask. So it was this experience of putting on a white mask to be made visible to a machine that sparked my curiosity and sent me down this road, which ended up becoming research exploring questions around computer science, artificial intelligence, computer vision in particular, and how do machines see people? Are there differences in that? So that's how I got to my current topic of study with algorithmic bias and discrimination.
And the work you're doing is so important. Can you break it down for us? What is artificial intelligence, and what does it mean for a machine to learn something?
Sure. So you can think of artificial intelligence as giving machines capabilities we might perceive as intelligence from humans, such as the ability to perceive the world or the ability to communicate or the ability to make decisions. So when we're talking about the ability to perceive the world, that's where using AI for something like computer vision can come in. If I have a self-driving car, I want to be able to detect the stoplights, detect the pedestrians. If we're thinking about communication, you might think about chatbots or some of the voice assistants you interact with, having an exchange back and forth where there's some level of understanding in order to have an interaction. And then finally, the other space that we oftentimes see AI being applied comes to decision making. And so it can be decision making about, do you get accepted or not to this college? Do you get hired or not for this job? We're starting to have AI systems that inform those kinds of decisions as well. So in short, I would say AI is about giving machines abilities we perceive as intelligence. And then to your other question about what does it mean for a machine to quote unquote learn something, there are different types of AI. And the kind of AI that is really commonplace right now because it's been shown to be effective in some instances, approach to AI called machine learning. So when you say machine learning, what does that mean? Well, it means the machine is learning from something, and that something is data. So instead of what we've done in the past when it comes to computer science, we're going to give a machine every single instruction for how to accomplish a task. With machine learning, what we say is instead of trying to give the computer explicit directions, we're going to give it a set of data points or a data set and have the machine learn a pattern. So right now, when we say machine learning, we're really talking about pattern recognition. So for what I study around facial recognition technologies, facial analysis technology, and so forth, we're talking about providing a machine with many examples of a face and then having a machine learning process go through to try to figure out what is the pattern that makes a human face.
So your graduate thesis at MIT threw you into the eye of the storm because you were looking at what makes a human face. And then you were able to uncover these very large racial and gender biases in AI services from companies like Microsoft, IBM, and Amazon. When did you first develop that hypothesis, and what was the process like for conducting that research?
Yes, so my MIT thesis was inspired by my own experience of coding in a white mask to have my face detected. And that's one kind of facial analysis task. Is there a face? Right? If you don't have a face, you can't get to some of the other tasks, like what kind of face is this? So I had this experience of not having my face detected, and I had the opportunity to share it in a TEDx talk that ended up on the homepage of TED.com. So now all of these people are seeing my experience because I did a little video demo of it, of having my darker skin face not being detected, but having the lighter skin face of my friend being detected. And so that was one example. And for research, you need more than one example. So that experience is what led me to start exploring how different systems work on different faces. And what I started to do was I took my TED profile image and I started running that image through different AI services that were offered by all kinds of companies, companies you've heard of, some you've never heard of. And what I found was mixed results. Some didn't detect my face. And then the ones that detected my face were labeling me male, even though I identify as a woman, I am female. And so I was really curious to see, okay, there's not being detected, which is some of the instances, was looking at the existing test data. And what I uncovered showed me why, as a field, we'd gotten so far thinking we were doing well when in fact there were these large disparities that you talked about, right? So there's the gender disparity. There's also the skin type disparity with lighter and darker skin, and then the intersectional disparity, which we'll get to. So I'm like, wait. I want to test these systems. But when I went to see the data sets to test the systems, the data sets weren't good enough. And the reason they weren't good enough is they didn't represent humanity at all. They were what I affectionately call pale male data sets. I looked at, for example, one of the gold standard data sets, right? This one, so many research papers in the field look at that data set. And that data set was over, I believe, 70% male and over 80% lighter skinned individuals. And so our measures for success themselves in the field were misleading, and they were misleading because they didn't quite represent all of humanity, which is a tall order, but they weren't even close, right? Like 80% lighter skinned individuals or so over 70% male. And so that's actually what led to the other part of my research, which was trying to develop a more inclusive data set. In this case, I created the Pilot Parliaments benchmark. And so what I did was, instead of taking the conventional wisdom that, oh, it's hard to find darker skinned faces, or, oh, it's just easier to get male faces, I thought, what if I look at a place that is also about representation, right? Which, when we think about governments, they're in some cases meant to be of the people, by the people, and representing the people. So I looked at parliaments in that way. And then I thought, okay, let me look at the parliaments that have a high proportion of women representatives. And so I went to the UN Women's website and I got a list of the top 10 nations in the world by their representation of women. And number one in the world, the number one country was Rwanda. And in the top 10, you actually had three other African countries. So from the African region, I chose Rwanda, I chose Senegal, and I chose South Africa based on their proportion of women in parliament. And because also I was choosing African countries with darker skinned individuals, I then wanted to look at light skin. And so then I looked at the Nordic countries, because not only did they have very light skinned, very fair people, but in terms of fairness, they had a better gender representation in their parliament. So the other countries that were well represented in that top 10 included Nordic countries. So I had Finland and Sweden and Iceland. So those are the six countries that I used to create this data set. And so now with this data set that was less pale and male, I was able to actually test AI systems from Microsoft in the first study, IBM, Face++, and then in the second study, we threw in Amazon and Kairos. And with this more inclusive data set, with a harder test, right, we started to see people didn't do quite as well as they did on the easier test. And so with the harder test, this is where we were able to show the consequential gender gap and the skin type gap. And the reason I keep saying skin type and not race is really important. When you're talking about computer vision, or you're talking about computers in general, like the concept of race doesn't mean anything, right? Or even if you're talking about humans, race changes over time, over geography. It's not stable. We're immigrants. My parents didn't become Black until we moved from Ghana to the U.S., right? How we even use race labels changes. And so because of that, I wanted to look at skin type, right? Darker skin, lighter skin. And there's actually a scientific scale called the Fitzpatrick scale that looks at skin response to UV radiation, right? So do you burn? Do you tan? What happens to your skin when the sunlight hits you? And so we were looking at that not to avoid race, but to say race as a social construct makes it difficult, knowing gender is not binary and yet having these binary categories. And even with the skin type scale that we were using, that itself had a skew. It's the Fitzpatrick skin type scale. When it was first made in the late 70s, there were 4 points to the scale, 3 types of white, and then the rest of the world. I honestly didn't know there were so many different ways to burn. I learned a lot doing the project. I was like, oh my goodness. And so the category that was literally the rest of the world, right, then got expanded into 3 others. So you have
three that are for light skin and three that are for different ranges of dark skin, but doesn't really capture it. I'm trying to say is even the ways in which I was trying to categorize themselves were problematic, but they were a step forward. And one of the major steps forward for our research was we didn't just look by gender and we didn't just look by skin type. We did what we call an intersectional analysis where we looked at gender and skin type together. So we didn't want to group all women together. We didn't want to group all light-skinned people together or all dark-skinned people together. So we had lighter-skinned females. We had darker-skinned females, lighter-skinned males, darker-skinned males. And when we did that, we actually found error gaps we wouldn't have seen if we had just done it by skin type and then just done it by gender. So one of the biggest gaps, the biggest gap we saw was between lighter skin males, where the error rates for the companies we tested were no more than 1%. And then for darker skinned females, they rose up to over 30% for those errors. And we wouldn't have seen that if we didn't break the data down in that way. So applying that kind of knowledge that was really coming from legal scholarship and also critical race theory to computer vision, it was able to introduce this other way of looking at the data, which has been informative.
I think it's so impressive the way that you were able to recognize the need to take on these different data sets. Obviously, when you have such a stark example that your face wasn't even being recognized by this technology, it's clear that we need to have more diverse data sets and we need to actually give computers more ways to make informed decisions. And you've talked about the importance of oversight and diversity of data for facial recognition technology. You even spoke to Congress about this. Can you tell us about what types of oversight and regulations you'd like to see for artificial intelligence?
Oh, these are great questions. So when it comes to the oversight of facial recognition technology, I was incredibly fortunate to be called as an expert witness to a congressional hearing. And so when I was called as an expert witness to a congressional hearing, it was a hearing on facial recognition technology asking what should we do. And my major recommendation was to put a moratorium on the use of facial recognition technology by law enforcement, and I would extend to other sensitive cases, like trying to use facial recognition to inform if, or facial analysis to inform if somebody should be hired or not. And my reason for this recommendation is given the research we have, right? So research from the Algorithmic Justice League, but also research from the National Institute of Standards and Technology on 189 algorithms from 99 different countries. Time and time again, we see not just gender bias or skin type bias, we see racial bias, we see age bias, where these systems don't work as well on youthful faces or don't work as well on older faces as they do middle age faces. In the government study, you also saw error rates that were 10 to 100 times worse when you compared, let's say, African American and Asian faces versus Caucasian faces, right? So given that we know there are these technical challenges, it would be irresponsible just on the technical side with what we know to use this in a high stakes situation where people's real lives can literally be hanging in the balance. So that's one of the reasons for the moratorium. But beyond the technical side, and this is something I came to learn more about as I moved out of the lab, right, and into other spaces, was what does this mean for civil rights and civil liberties? Because let's say we have perfectly accurate facial recognition technology. This is a hypothetical world. We don't have that. In this world with improved facial recognition technology where your movements can be tracked, right? That's a threat to the First Amendment for freedom of assembly, where your associations can be tracked. And this isn't just some hypothetical thing. You had in Baltimore at the Freddie Gray protest, facial recognition technology being deployed on people who were there protesting. So this can lead to chilling effects. And one of the things that makes a democracy is our ability to speak up and protest against what's happening and not necessarily necessarily be under the threat of facing retaliation for it. And so there's that aspect. But then there's also the Fourth Amendment, right, which basically says if you're going to be searched, there has to be probable cause, right? There needs to be a warrant. There needs to be a reason. If you have facial recognition technology being used for mass surveillance, that's essentially being searched all the time without your knowledge, without the appropriate steps being taken. And then just as importantly, we also have to think about the 14th Amendment, which gives us a right to due process. This means if there's a decision made, you have a right to understand how that decision was reached. But if companies don't tell you how facial recognition technology or facial analysis is being used, and let's say a company like HireVue, right, uses this kind of technology in their software to interview job candidates, you actually have no kind of recourse. How do you push against the power you don't see? So none of this has to do with the technical aspect per se. And in fact, the better these systems become from a technical perspective, the worse these other risks become when you're thinking about civil liberties as well. And so the other major component about this is when these systems fail, and it could be they're failing on a technical side, or it could be they're failing because they're breaching our civil rights and liberties, the people who are most impacted are those who are already marginalized, those who are already vulnerable. And so that was another major component of the congressional testimony, which was to say the people have a voice and a choice. And how facial recognition has been rolled out has bypassed the democratic process, right? Congressman, you had Jim Jordan and AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, in agreement, right? And here you have bipartisan support on the need to address facial recognition technology, because there's this fundamental understanding that our faces aren't just up for grabs and it changes our relationship with society. So I called my spoken testimony, Face the Final Frontier of Privacy, because if we are not careful about the next steps we take when it comes to what we're doing with biometric surveillance technologies like facial recognition, we can create this Orwellian authoritative state because we weren't paying attention or because we didn't speak up. And so that's part of why I started the Algorithmic Justice League. There's this component that's saying here is the academic research, you know, research that I did at MIT that shows technical fallibilities with these systems. But also here's the other component, how are our lives impacted? And most importantly, what kind of societies do we want to be living in? And that is not a technical question. That's a question of values.
There's so much more to dig into and to talk about with regards to ethics and AI. So I wanted to switch gears a bit. In addition to legislation, you've also used art and poetry to convey fairness and inclusivity in technology. I mean, in particular, your spoken word piece, AI Ain't I Woman, was so powerful and moving to me. And it was amazing how you showed how the faces of iconic women like Oprah, Michelle Obama, Serena Williams were all failed by AI. So why do you choose to share your work in art museums? And why do you think code is art?
It's interesting. I was a little bit afraid to do AI Ain't I a Woman, because as somebody who has a computer science background and was doing a graduate degree in a technical space, you're often told to leave your emotions at home, right? Lest your emotions seep into your research and bias the results, which is completely understandable. Just if you have one view or another and you conduct a experiment, the experiment should be set up such that what the results are what the results are, regardless of your views. The notion of bringing in the subjectivity of art almost seemed to push against how I had been trained. But at the same time, I am an artist. I am an expressive person. I am a, this is why I call myself a poet of code. And for a very long time, I thought I couldn't bring those worlds together. So AI Ain't I a Woman was a way of processing my own reactions and feelings about the research that I conducted for my MIT master's thesis, which is the research that showed large gender disparities, large skin type disparities, which then map onto racial disparities and their intersections for gender classification, to the kind of work that I was doing. So a line like, can machines ever see my queens as I view them? Can machines ever see our grandmothers as we knew them? This shifts it again from this, what are the metrics, to what does it mean? And to also bring in the historic aspect as well, I thought was important. Sometimes people will say, AI, ain't I a woman? Don't you know ain't isn't a word, etc. And they're not always seeing the reference to Sojourner Truth's speech from the 19th century, mid-19th century, Ain't I a Woman, where she was talking about the need for the women's rights movement that was really starting at that time in the U.S. And so AI, Ain't I a Woman was this nod to Sojourner Truth. And so then to have an iconic image of Sojourner Truth where she's labeled as a clean-shaven old man by Google, right? It's like, what are the implications of that? Or having somebody like Ida B. Wells, I call her a data science pioneer, hanging facts, stacking stats on the lynching of humanity, because she was an investigative journalist and she used her platform to trace out how lynchings were happening across the U.S. South. And she showed that there was a direct economic link, right? You don't always necessarily remember her in that way, but talking to Megan Smith, and she described Ida B. Wells to me as a data science pioneer. And so that part stuck with me as well. And so AI Ain't I a Woman allowed me to also nod to the history of so many women whose lives and whose advocacy have made the work that I do possible, and then bring it to the present day, right? To have Oprah Winfrey labeled male by Amazon was surprising to me, in so much as we talk about having machines learn from data. Well, there's one woman who has a lot of data in terms of images out there, right? And one of those women is Oprah Winfrey. And then Michelle Obama, I was surprised her hair being described as a toupee. Even with Ida B. Wells, I think she was being described as a small boy in a hat, you know, so seeing black hair not quite registering. There's another one that describes the hair as a coonskin cap. And the thing is, before I did AI Ain't I a Woman, right, which is about these historic, iconic women, right? So we have your Serena Williams and your Sojourner Truth. We did something called the Black Panther Scorecard, which was looking at the fictional women of Wakanda. And so with the women of Wakanda, we were also getting people being misgendered or labeled in different ways. But what was interesting between doing the Black Panther scorecard and AI Ain't I a Woman was the mistakes hit me in a different kind of way when they were women I admired. When some of the people you admire the most, right, are somehow denigrated by the AI systems from the companies that are said to be the leading tech companies in the world. And when you ask why I put it in museums or have it in art spaces, it's because I see how people react to the visual elements as well as the words of that poem. And art spaces enable those sorts of experiences to happen and to be shared and to be contemplated. So, but it was a risk because it's not the typical way to share research or the implications of research, but it was true to me. And I think there's a humanity that's captured in it that resonates with other people. And so it does end with this line, which I think is really important, which is no label is worthy of our beauty. And so much of AI, so much of machine learning is about classifying and labeling and putting people or things into boxes. And so this reminder to not be boxed in the first place is really what ends AI Ain't I a Woman.
And I love how your latest piece was voicing erasure. And I thought it was so incredible how you used this piece in order to really highlight how there are so many different vectors of discrimination, but how voice is really one of those.
Yes. So voicing erasure came together in 4 days. So it is literally the most recent project as of our having this conversation from the Algorithmic Justice League. And how that project got started is I got a cold email from a woman named Allison, who's the lead author of an incredible paper that just came out that shows racial disparities when it comes to voice recognition systems from big companies, including your Microsoft and your IBM and your Amazons and so forth. And this research, rightfully so, was covered by the New York Times. However, in the coverage of this research, the journalist quoted 7 men and no women. Mind you, the lead author of the paper is a woman, and I believe around half of the authors of the paper were women. And in the space of algorithmic bias, some of the leading voices and the leading scholarship have been produced by women. And so there was an irony in reading this paper about racial bias in voice recognition systems, or in this case, to be more technical, automated speech recognition, in that particular piece, to then have this obvious gender bias as well. And so when she reached out to me, it made me think about the different types of erasure you can face, erasure from both humans and machines, right? Or to think about machines of flesh and blood, right? The networks and the systems we put together, right? When we talk about systematic bias, you can think about that as machines of flesh and blood, as well as the machines of silicon and steel, which you might associate more with an automated speech recognition system or some of the commercial voice assistants that are out there. And so the irony of the whole situation, and also being able to empathize with Allison in so much as I know what it's like to do work you're proud of and to lead work and to not be recognized from it, to be erased from your own contribution. And it's not something that's just particular to this one research paper or only particular to women, right? I think so many people from all walks of life can relate to that experience of being erased. And so that's really what led to voicing erasure. And so part of that spoken word piece was to bring together many different voices, including some of the voices that could have been and should have been in that New York Times article on her work. So Allison's voice is definitely part of it. We were so fortunate to have Kimberly Crenshaw lend her voice to the work as well. And I mentioned earlier how a lot of the intersectionality components and so forth, that builds directly on her scholarship and the scholarship of other women who've explored intersectionality. And then we have people like Dr. Sasha Kostanzichak. They recently released the book Design Justice. And you have Dr. Sophia Noble with the book Algorithms of Oppression. And you have Dr. Ruha Benjamin, who recently had her book, Race After Technology. You have Megan Smith, the former CTO, Chief Technology Officer of the United States. And they were all very gracious in lending their voice to this project in support of Allison and also in support of raising up marginalized, diminished, or otherwise erased voices in a broad way. We also critique the fact that voice assistants, right, tend to be putting women in a subservient role, recipients of demands, and that is not by accident. Either. So there are all kinds of critiques happening in the piece. And it was also fun to play with synthetic voices as well. So it's not, there are real voices and then there are few synthetic voices that are woven in throughout the piece. But that's how it started, recognizing sadly all too familiar story of being erased from your own contribution. The experience I had of that resonates the most when I think about Allison's example is when I was an undergraduate, I led this project on neglected tropical diseases, building mobile surveying tools. And I did it for a well-known nonprofit working in the global health space. I went to Ethiopia. I led the design of this tool. It saved a significant amount of time and money. So from all of the metrics, I had done a good job in leading the project. And so when it came to share the project, I did the presentation, et cetera, and I also had one of my team members with me. Now, my team member looks like your quintessential tech bro. I do not. And so even after I presented, you know, sharing the work, and then he came on, the person moderating the whole meeting kept referring to the project as Andrew's project. Now, Andrew, no doubt, was a part of it, but even the people who were in the field, they were trying to combat it, like, enjoy it, you know, that kind of thing, because they saw what was going on. But that was, as an undergrad, really my first public experience of seeing that you can have the merit, because sometimes it's easy to say, oh, well, if you work hard enough, the merit will show, excellence always comes through, it's fine. And so that was really the first major lesson for me, where you can produce the results, right? But nonetheless, somebody else can get the credit for what you've done, particularly if they embody the quote unquote look of what leadership is envisioned to be. With the Algorithmic Justice League, we very much believe in naming and changing, not naming and shaming. And so, one, let's make art out of this experience that has many universal qualities. Let's also reach out specifically to the people involved in this particular instance, and let's figure out how we do better.
What an incredible and unconventional path and journey that you've had. Thank you for sharing the inception stories of all of those projects with us. So we'd love to end each interview with a question around actionable advice and also a lightning round of bite-sized questions. So to kick it off, can you give us one piece of actionable advice that has helped you in pushing forward your vision?
One piece of actionable advice I would say is sticking to your story and your experience as something that is worthy of exploration. When I first said I wanted to research facial analysis systems or look at facial recognition technologies, I actually had interesting pushback, which wasn't supportive, even from people who I thought would be supportive. If you talk about things like bias, or if you get into racism or sexism, that's going to color your work in a way where you're not going, people are going to put you in that box, right? So even though I saw what I experienced with coding in the white mask and then thinking about all of these different areas in which AI is going to be used, I knew this was an important area to explore. A piece of advice that I have is when you think something is important because of how it resonates to you, don't be discouraged if other people don't see it. The very people who said those things, they're big supporters of the Algorithmic Justice League now. And it's not, again, not everybody sees what you see as you see it. The conversation in 2016, when it comes to AI and bias and discrimination and thinking about algorithmic justice or equity, isn't what it is in 2020. And I do believe some of the work we've done as the Algorithmic Justice League has had an influence on that.
It's just so impressive to me how much you've been able to change the industry, change the dialogue, change the conversation with what you're doing with Algorithmic Justice League. And thank you so much for refusing to fit into those boxes and paving a path and pushing that forward. My first question for you is, what are three things always on your desk?
I usually have my idea notebook in case something cool comes to mind, so I can sketch it or jot it down somewhere. I have a thing for glasses. It's a podcast, so I might have to share some photos, but I have all kinds of glasses. And then I'm about my swag life, so there's AJL business cards, AJL stickers, that kind of thing. So that That tends to be on my desk along with maybe like some Ensure or something like that.
What is one class every college student should take?
Ooh, I got lucky because I went to this crazy place called the Media Lab where we had classes like Toys to Think With and Science Fabrication. And so the art project that I was working on that became the Algorithmic Justice League came from taking this class called Science Fabrication. What's science fabrication? You read science fiction and then you build something that would otherwise be crazy, taboo, or thought improbable. That's inspired through the science fiction you're reading.
I love it. And last question, favorite Sundance film?
Coded Bias, because yes. I'm heavily biased, and it features how I go from a grad student to a digital advocate and pushing towards algorithmic justice alongside a beautiful ensemble of women. I'm very biased, but I would say the best Sundance Film Festival documentary is Coded Bias.
Well, Joy, thank you so much for joining us on TechSetters today, and I absolutely can't wait to go watch your film. TechSetters is a Code with Classy podcast powered by If Then. If we can empower a woman in STEM, then she can change the world.